I hope you all slept well. Great to see you here again this morning. Well, I didn't think you'd all go away. So, a really great conference. It's, as I was saying last night, I think we're coming to a tipping point in our understanding of what it's all about. Methods for achieving non-duality are beginning to spring up, and I would recommend all of you to now start looking at those teachers who we have, and there are a large number of them, that can increase your understanding and appreciation of non-duality. Very important. Most of you will have had spiritual experiences or spiritual openings of some sort or another, or call them, if you like, conscious openings. And it's really a question of learning more about that and then going deeper into yourself and encouraging these much wider feelings and senses that you have so that you can actually see what a non-dual world looks like. Well, perhaps you all do anyway. One can never tell. Ravi and I were talking, and I was saying, and he was saying what a nice audience we were. And then I liked that. And then he was saying, I wonder if it's because we all have a certain degree of maturity. And he challenged me to ask you, all those under 50, if they could let us know. That's good. That's very good. Well done. That's fantastic. And as I was saying last night, the fact that network members of the next generation are coming forward is enormously exciting. So let me introduce Ravi Ravindra to you. He's a great friend of ours. He's a great personal friend of mine, because I've sat at Ravi's feet on many occasions and listened to his accounts of his own spiritual journey, but not only that, of the people he's met and dealt with. He's a professor of physics, philosophy, and religion. Now, come on, what could be a better, better degree, I mean, a better qualified person for a meeting such as this, which is, after all, about integration. Halifax, I don't know how many of you have been to Halifax. How many of you have been to Halifax? This is Halifax, Canada. Oh, Ravi. There are very few of them, Ravi. I'm sorry. It's obviously not a popular destination.
There is a bank here called Halifax.
That's why I put in Canada. And those of you who don't know, there's a lovely street in Halifax where you can buy old artifacts, and they did have, and the second time I went, they didn't. The most wonderful old gramophones. Do you remember these wind-up ones with the horns? You could get a wonderful example of that. And so that's one of my views of Halifax. Ravi, of course, has huge experience himself and has... I always think of Ravi when I think of Krishnamurti. And Ravi's accounts of Krishnamurti are absolutely spellbinding. And Ravi will tell you about the difference between his mind and that of Krishnamurti's. And I remember, Ravi, there was a mill involved. And so I think it's absolutely fitting that we should have Ravi here for our first talk when we're considering integration. And so, Ravi, Eternal Spiritual Wisdom and Modern Science. Let's welcome Ravi Ravindra.
I thought I should stand up, otherwise I can't see the people in the back there. And I will speak for about half the total time allotted to me so that people can ask questions. Feel free, even to heckle me. I'm accustomed to it. And, let me begin with a remark from the most ancient text in any Indo-European language, the Rig Veda. na vijanami yadi vedam asmi ninyasanadham manasacharami. I don't know what I am, whether I am the same as this cosmos, yet conceited in my mind, I wonder. Nothing seems to have changed in the last several thousand years. This is really the... There are some of you who are a little bit familiar with Sanskrit would recognize two words in this, aham and idam, myself and the cosmos. These are the two great mysteries. And I should say here that I personally have never met anybody who is not interested in both. So all this rigmarole about whether people are scientists or whether they are interested in spiritual matters, is there anybody who is not interested in both? Even the most diehard reductionist scientist is a human being. He or she falls in love and occasionally wonders what will happen when I die. These are the standard spiritual questions. Similarly, surely, is there anybody who doesn't sometimes wonder why those stars shine, why are the leaves green, or how do butterflies suddenly emerge from... These are all standard scientific questions. So I invite you not to let experts get into this. Everybody is naturally interested. Of course, they may not do any of this professionally or in a die-hard fashion because it's not so easy, especially to do science. But matters of spiritual concern cannot not be of interest to human beings. What I would like to do is to really essentially take all of these words in this topic that has been assigned to me and proceed to say something about each of these. These two great mysteries that I just spoke about, myself and the cosmos, all the spiritual teachers throughout human history have said that they both emerge or arise from or are created by one being. The Sanskrit word is tad ekam, that one. Naturally, variously labeled as God or Brahma or Allah or some other label, or the Absolute. It's necessary for us not to be so taken over by one word or the other. Languages vary. Every culture has its history. But what is very important, something I actually even in the meditation this morning try to remind, as far as I am aware, and if you know any exception to this, please help me to know that exception. All the sages in the history of humanity have said, without exception that I am aware of, that the entire space is filled with conscious and subtle energies. Naturally, the labels vary. Filled with Brahma, with Allah, with the Holy Spirit. If it is true, and we have to have a lot of chutzpah to ignore all the sages and all the great philosophers and the great scientists. Einstein, Newton, they all would agree. They would call it Holy Spirit or cosmic intelligence. If it is true, Holy Spirit is right here. It's mostly the religious people, so-called religious people, who don't seem to be aware of this fact, that whatever they are doing is under the vision of Allah, Holy Spirit, Krishna, whatever label appeals to you. If it is true, then the question is, how do I become receptive to this? Because these energies are far subtler than we are. It's the very meaning of the word spiritual, that it is something subtler than the body and the mind. Every tradition has insisted that there are many levels of reality, many of them subtler than the mind. But within the spiritual realm also there are many levels. For example, just to remind you, in the Bible you have 9 orders of angels between human beings and God. These are all different levels of spirituality. Sometimes somebody has one parapsychological experience, they certainly think they're at the level of the Buddha. There are many levels within the spiritual realm. So, keeping this in mind, there is another aspect of the eternal spiritual traditions, that everything originates from the highest level of consciousness. Just a reminder again and again, because I'm partly intentionally trying to relate it with the assumptions of the modern science. According to modern science, this is just an assumption, that everything comes from the lowest level of consciousness. Dead matter. You, me, everything in the universe has come from the lowest level of consciousness. So the word evolution actually makes sense in the scientific context. It is used in spiritual context as well, but quite differently. There, the word evolution of a person is intended to indicate returning home, returning to the source. If I can become aware of my oneness with the Divine Spirit, that would be evolution of my consciousness. So it's not that the word is missing there, but it has a very different meaning. One needs to be very clear about this. In the scientific realm, when we speak about evolution, we mean by that the cause is at a lower level than the effect. This was not the case even in European science until the 16th century, where the cause was at a higher level than the effect. Galileo, Kepler, continuing on to Newton, that's the major scientific revolution. Their cause was at the same level as the effect. Much more interest, how does state A change into state B? But they were at the same level. It's only after the theory of evolution proposed by Darwin that the cause became at a lower level than the effect, and then that enters into cosmology, which was not earlier, hardly 100 years away. 100 years ago, it would have been surprising to every physicist that the cosmos is evolving. As you probably all know, Einstein said this was his greatest blunder. Therefore, because one of the consequences of the theory of relativity was that there is a evolution of the universe, so he introduced something called the cosmic constant. All those details we probably don't need to go into. By the way, that's my field generally in physics, so I'll be happy to go into the details of that. However, coming back to the idea that it is a fundamental assumption of modern science that matter is primary and has no consciousness, then somehow some particles come together, unicellular life begins. We may not know all these details, but we don't know the other way around either. So we don't need to have this against modern science. But the notion is the question of the fundamental assumption that I'm speaking about here. Then I already mentioned about the idea of levels of reality. But then there is a very strong suggestion in all spiritual traditions that there is a correspondence between levels of reality outside and levels within ourselves. Perhaps more simply expressed by Saint Paul, eyes of the flesh see the things of the flesh, eyes of the spirit the things of the spirit. And that all our scientific instruments, microscopes, telescopes, etc., are quantitative extensions of the eyes of the flesh. Therefore, naturally, they cannot see angels. William Blake has no problem seeing angels. Christ has no problem seeing angels. Should we just dismiss them? To see angels would require eyes of the spirit. The word angel doesn't need to be taken over. For example, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna shows his great form to Arjuna. Arjuna is unable to see. Then Krishna says, you cannot see me with your ordinary eyes. I will give you divine eyes. Divya Chakshu Dadami Tvam. So the point to be made here is that absolutely at the heart of any spiritual practice, anywhere, anytime, is the transformation of a person. It's the classical idea that as long as if there is one lesson from all the scriptures, at least that I have encountered, teachings of all the sages, if you know any exception, please help me. And this is why I'm repeating this idea. But if there is one single lesson from all of these teachers and scriptures, it is simply this. As long as I remain the way I am, I cannot come to the truth or to God. Invitation for a radical transformation of the whole of my being. Body, mind, feelings. Christ, Nicodemus comes to visit Christ, third chapter of John's Gospel. By the way, it slightly interests me because he was a member of the Jewish Sanhedrin. It'll be a little bit like a cardinal in the Vatican going to visit the Dalai Lama for spiritual counsel. So he has to come in the middle of the night. So he has to sort of sneak out. Doesn't want to waste any time. The very first question he asks, how may I enter the kingdom of heaven? We could replace this by, how could I come to God? How do I come to truth? What is the response? Unless you are born again, born from above, born of the Spirit, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. If you know any exception to this, the words will be different, to be sure. But always the suggestion everywhere that you have to be radically reborn. Each one of us is naturally a child of flesh, but the invitation is to become also a child of the Spirit. Born from above, born of the Spirit is the exact quote from John's Gospel. In India, we have a word called dwij, meaning twice born. Now it simply becomes a caste label. This happens in every tradition. Count it from me. This is degeneration is inevitable. This is lawful, which is why periodically things need to be renewed, refreshed. In any case, coming back to the point that I'm basically trying to make, a very strong emphasis on the radical transformation. I will come back to this here, exactly what is the meaning of this. Nobody in any scientific work requires you to be radically transformed in the sense that it is used in the spiritual tradition. Well, maybe I should just get into this right now. Here is a remark of Christ in the Gospel of Matthew. Unless you leave yourself behind, you cannot be a follower of mine. That's the requirement. What is the self doing? By the way, one of the noble truths of the Buddha, there is suffering. Second one, why is there suffering? Because of selfishness. That's why there is suffering. So this is not unique to one tradition or the other. I'm speaking actually intentionally of something which is common to all the spiritual traditions. Naturally, the words change, words vary, language changes. So, how do I leave myself behind? What does it actually mean? If I am occupied with me, 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 my accomplishment, my achievement, that's not leaving the self behind. Freedom from the self is an essential requirement of any spiritual practice. We don't demand this in science. I have personally been rather fortunate to have met some absolutely remarkable people. If you took a list of Nobel Prize winners, certainly the ones I have met, some of them you wouldn't want to invite home for lunch. But some you'll be quite happy to have join you. So it's nothing to do with a requirement in the scientific discipline that one be free of the self. But no spiritual discipline could possibly be, if you like, in any sense accomplished. We have actually a remark in the very ancient text in India, Shatapath Brahman, that when a searcher comes to the sun door and the question is, who is it? If the answer is anything other than nobody, he may not enter. So really, this is such a fundamental requirement in any spiritual teaching that I'm always... Actually, everything I'm saying is completely obvious, but somehow it needs to be said again and again. So let me continue with this one very radical difference. If I take two main streams of spirituality in the world, one is obviously the biblical one, starting from Prophet Abraham to Prophet Muhammad. And then the other one, the Indian one, in which we would include whatever we label Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism. There is one very radical difference, and it creates a lot of differences. Because I just finished saying earlier that it is a general idea that the levels within oneself are corresponding to the levels outside oneself, and that this is where it is eyes of the spirit need to see the things of the spirit. But here comes a radical distinction. In the biblical tradition, God created the world, and there is a very radical distinction between the creator and creation. At every level, just quickly to remind you, Lucifer was the highest of all angels. Literally, the word Lucifer means the light bearer, highest of all angels. Why was he expelled from heaven? Here I'm quoting Prophet Isaiah. Because he wished to be like the Most High. This is the basic heresy or blasphemy in the whole biblical tradition. You all know, in the Jewish tradition, Christ saying, "My Father and I are one," that's heresy. Within the Christian tradition, anybody who occasionally came even close to it, Meister Eckhart as an example, he was excommunicated. Many of them were burned at the stake, etc. Similarly, in Islam, Al-Halaj, many other examples. Whereas in the Indian tradition, first of all, there is really no creation myth in India. There is fundamentally an emanation myth. The whole manifested universe has emanated from Brahma. So Brahma is not only in everything, it is everything. It's a very important distinction to keep in mind. Therefore, it is actually the consequence of that, that the whole Indian culture is practically obsessed with the idea of oneness of all there is, because it is in the very fundamental starting point. There is no distinction, strictly speaking, between secular and sacred, because everything, even the what we would call dead matter, has some aspect of Brahma. Therefore, in India, it is actually the mark of the greatness of a sage if he or she can actually, honestly say, "I am Brahma. My Father and I are one," is one way of saying this, but saying exactly the same. There it would be regarded as a mark of the greatness of a sage. Exactly what Christ himself is saying. As you probably all recall, he was accused of destroying the tradition, and I quote him here, "I have not come to destroy the tradition, but to fulfill it." This is Christ's own remark. He's fulfilling the tradition. But this radical difference is very significant, and one consequence of that is, it will take me a long time, but I'll be happy if any questions arise about it. I'll go into more details of this. In the biblical tradition, the emphasis is not on oneness of all there is. It is on the uniqueness of everything that is. I invite you to seriously consider this, because it will be rather strange to imagine that half the sages of the world got the matter wrong. Because this is the tendency. We become accustomed to one way of speaking. One sage has spoken, especially a great sage speaks in a certain way. After that, everybody thinks that's the only way to express truth. Something else. Otherwise, we might tolerate them, but that's somehow not true. I'm inviting you, first of all, to consider all the sages, including Christ, including the Buddha, including Krishna, everybody that you know of, has said that what is really highest reality cannot be expressed. But having said that, they do say something. Partly because their disciples are always eager for them to say something. But I am again inviting you to realize whatever they are saying is not to say what the reality is, but to invite you to find ways of connecting with it. This is a very important distinction here. Let me actually jump ahead. I'll return to this point. In scientific work, especially in physics, all perceptions are in the service of theory. Don't take my word for it. If you know any exception to anything I'm saying, we make a hypothesis. In fact, I should even have said, it's in the service of a hypothesis. Then we subject it to certain measurements, and if it agrees, fine, then the theory is established. Otherwise, we look for another theory. Newton even made this remark. He was being criticized for his theory of gravitation. He says, any theory is better than no theory. So you come up with a better one, then we can test that. Whereas in all spiritual traditions, there is no shortage of theory there either, but theory in the service of perception. Not the other way around. If any theory, any words assist you to directly perceive something, then that theory is okay. It's helping you. Otherwise, you can forget about that theory. There is no shortage of theory in Buddhism or in yoga literature or anywhere else. Lots of theory. But the purpose of that theory is to assist perception, not the other way around. Let me return to the point that I especially wanted to make here now, because there is such fascination with oneness that one forgets the importance of the uniqueness. In the biblical tradition, first of all, if you know any exception, please help me. You'll find many expressions in India from many sages that one's individual consciousness merged into the cosmic consciousness. If you know a single example of this in the biblical tradition, I'll be delighted to hear. Because there, the emphasis is on the uniqueness of the individual even after death. Even in the presence of Almighty. Now, this is a quotation from Exodus. Moses spoke to God as a man to a man. Even in the presence of the Almighty, a person retains one's individuality, one's uniqueness. Don't easily get away from this. As I said, you could hardly believe that half the sages of the world just got the matter wrong. If you actually don't get now stuck with the words, but look at the actual behavior of any of the sages, of the Buddha or of Christ as an example, I just take these two. One could hardly do better by taking these two. The way they behaved towards their disciples was a very subtle combination of the awareness of oneness of all there is, but uniqueness of each of their disciples. oneness without uniqueness will move away from manifestation. And uniqueness without awareness of the oneness becomes insignificant. The manifested universe requires uniqueness of every blade of grass. Also, CIA requires it. Your fingerprints are unique. But more importantly, let me actually here give you standard scientific data about this. 99.9% of our DNA is shared by each one of us. It's common. But that 0.1% leads to enough uniqueness, 10^3,480,000,000. If you were to write this number, it'll take about 50 books, standard size books, to write this number. The total number of atoms in the universe, give or take a few billion. You know how it is, it keeps changing. But the total number of atoms in the universe is about 10^90. I'm talking about 10^3,480,000,000 degrees of uniqueness. Now, speaking a little differently, Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says, a sage realizes that all there is Krishna. But even Krishna cannot replace a single child. Each one of us needs to bring our unique song of praise for God, if you like, absolutely uniquely. It will be a total tragedy if we all were doing the same thing. Uday Shankar dancing is quite different from Bach writing music, or from Dante doing poetry, or Einstein doing physics. It is necessary to actually emphasize a very subtle combination of both oneness and uniqueness. And the two major streams of spirituality that I was speaking about actually emphasize two different sides. Now, then, of course, the title of my talk is Eternal Spiritual Wisdom. That's already a problem. Eternity is not an extension of time. It's actually orthogonal to the dimension of time. Leaves no cosine function on the time axis. Leaves no projection on the time axis. But it is not against time. It can intersect with time at any time. Which is why when the Buddha was enlightened, it is said he became nirakal, which is to say beyond time or timeless. Sometimes it is said kala vimukt, free of time. But also became a trikal darshi, which is to say seer of three times, past, present and future. So these are not contradictory to each other. Maybe I give a simple example. Probably most of you would have experienced this. Relationship between love and marriage. Marriage has a history. Love does not have a history. It can be outside marriage, it can be inside marriage, it can be present for a moment, and then for 1 hour it's not, or for 1 day, 1 month, 1 year it's not there. Love does not leave a projection in time. Marriage does. Okay? So eternity, when we speak about eternal wisdom, we are not speaking about extension in time. Although there is a habit to think of eternal as everlasting. Everlasting is not always eternal. I have a whole article on this actually in one of my books here. We have many stories like this in India, but probably everywhere. you do great practice of something and you're getting given a boon. You can ask for whatever you like. And if you are not quick enough to ask for it, this character will, some genie who emerges will give you trouble. So some sage couldn't think of what to ask. So he asked this genie, okay, erect a pole. You go up the pole. When you go up, then you come down. When you come down, you go up. So everlastingly he's doing it. That's not the sense of eternal wisdom, let me assure you. It is a very common idea in the spiritual traditions that the truth or reality or God is eternal, timeless, not against time. No scientific law is free of time. What sense would we make of Christ saying, this is in the 8th chapter of John's Gospel, before Abraham was, I am. Obviously, it doesn't make any sense to the people who are listening to him either. Just to remind you, it's in the same chapter. In the beginning, they are willing to crown him the king. By the end of that chapter, they are throwing stones at him to try to kill him. That's where we all are. Things don't make sense, so we have to get rid of this somehow. You can read the Bhagavad Gita, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. The highest state of consciousness is free of time sequence. Everywhere, the suggestion that time is just one component of manifestation, but that a real sage is free of time in any sense that I just spoke about. Not against time. This I have to keep repeating this because there is always a tendency thinking very dualistically, as if one is therefore against time. None of these sages are against time. They can manifest at any time, but not bound by time. In this connection, I should remind you, this was 1985, the Royal Society of Canada had organized a symposium on origin and evolution of the universe, evidence for design, with a question mark. They had invited about a dozen people, actually three or four from England. And I presented a paper there called In the Beginning is the Dance of Love. It's in my book, Science and the Sacred, here. Twice, without even asking me, the proofreader changed it. In the beginning was the dance of love. You see, similarly in John's Gospel, in the beginning is the Word. It should be in the beginning is the Word, but it is always in the beginning was the Word, as if it is a matter of some time dimension going to zero point. That is the point I'm trying to make, that the sense of eternity is not an extension of the time dimension back to zero. It's supposed to be orthogonal to the dimension of time. And whereas, actually the very idea, when one says there are dimensions of reality subtler than the mind, there is already, mind cannot think without. Immanuel Kant in particular had 12 categories of thought. Time, space, causality, quantity, I have forgotten the others. But time, in any case, is what I wanted to now focus on. So we cannot actually think without time. Even when we use the word timeless or eternity, mentally somehow one has this notion of time. So to say that spiritual realities are dealing with something called eternal or eternity is a reminder that this is supramental. Another aspect, all our scientific work, intentionally, this is nothing against it, wants to remove the what they call the personal equation. That means whether the Buddha is looking at something or I am looking at something, only those observations will be accepted which are common to both of us. And in any case, in physics, at least in the last 100 years, nobody is observing anything. It's all the instruments. The scientists are back home having lunch. Earlier we used to have graduate students having to still sit there, but now we have more research grants, so even they can go home. No observation is made by any human being. If you know any exception to what I'm saying, please help, because I know in a way I'm saying absolutely obvious things, but all observations are made by instruments. So it doesn't matter whether the Buddha is looking at it or some completely scoundrel like me looking at it. The quality of being of the person is irrelevant to scientific observation. Whereas the whole project of spiritual disciplines is to do with the quality of being of the person. There are two remarks I want to make, and that will take a long time for me to sort of defend them, so at present I'll just make them dogmatically. Mind does not experience anything. All experience is by the senses and the feelings. In the sciences, external senses, in spiritual disciplines, internal senses. I can close my eyes now and I say, I see what's going on. You see what I'm saying? This is an internal sense one is talking about. We have many great sages, especially Sri Anirvan comes to my mind right now, died in 1978, who actually makes this remark that even the subtlest spiritual experience is actually experienced as a sensation in the body, very subtle sensation, which is why so much emphasis on more and more sensitivity. If somebody says, I was touched by an angel or I heard the voice of God, we may question whether it, but it has the possibility of having some truth to it. But if somebody says, I was thinking about God, well, it's not a bad idea, but that doesn't mean any experience about it. So we need to be clear. Mind does not experience. It can take a measurement or an observation and then say, oh, if we change this parameter or that parameter, maybe we can see then what is the result of that. So it's not that the mind is irrelevant, but it does not experience. Another remark I want to make, especially in matters concerning with ultimate reality or anything to do with spiritual, what scientists say is not what science says. If we can, I happily myself often quote many remarks from Einstein. Some of you have probably even heard many of them. They all need to be questioned, such as science without religion is lame, religion without science is blind. I think this is one of his. It sounds nice. Religious people are happy to include all this. But can you show this to me in any scientific journal? And I'm inviting you, whether you are criticizing spirituality or ignoring it, denying it, or you are supporting it, what scientists say is not what science says. If you know exceptions, I'll be happy to learn. I keep repeating this remark again and again because I'm making many generalizations here for the simple reason because of the limitation of time. So, we need to be careful that the whole emphasis is on self-transformation in the spiritual teachings. And that is intimately connected with self-awareness, self-knowledge, self-observation, self-inquiry. These will be the sorts of many words get used for this. Swadhyaya in Sanskrit. Because awareness is the mechanism of transformation. Here I now make a quite a general statement, particularly emphasized by spiritual teachers. Whatever I become aware of changes in its quality and in its relationship with me. Therefore, self-awareness and self-transformation are not two things. It's a spiral movement. Therefore, there can hardly be any spiritual undertaking without emphasizing self-study. Because if self-transformation is the emphasis, I need to know what is it that needs to be transformed. Why am I stuck with the way I am, etc. And therefore, these are all really, as I said, quite obvious things. But let me now, again, the emphasis that gets placed on observations externally becomes the hallmark of our scientific work. Max Planck, long time ago, made this remark, whatever cannot be measured cannot be real. Just as a contrast to remind you, Shankara, perhaps the most highly regarded philosopher in India, I'm not personally a great fan of his, but he's very highly regarded in India, said, whatever can be measured cannot possibly be real. Why? The whole idea of reality is different. If reality is constricted by any measurement, it cannot be eternal. The word eternal seems to have only reference to time, but there is also the suggestion of spacelessness, if you like. The word Brahma, by the way, literally means the vastness, both in time and in space. And so the very idea of reality is radically different in the two cases. Now, one of the things I want to, maybe I should close here so that we can have some questions here. It seems to me we should remember scientists are also human beings. Every human being, whatever they are doing, naturally wishes to feel a kind of sense of some ultimate meaning in whatever they are doing. Why not? I have actually, if you ever get a chance to speak to, say, somebody working as a janitor, you will be surprised. They would find some sense of ultimate meaning in the sense of service they are providing. Why not? After all, human beings have that need. So, therefore, we should hardly be against scientists then making some of these grand generalizations. I often say science is a spiritual path for many scientists, not for everybody, because spiritual path requires, by definition, an understanding that there is something higher than my usual level. There was no such problem for Newton or for Einstein or for Schrödinger or many, many other scientists. Just to also to remind you, Darwin had only one degree. That was a degree in theology. Often people don't know. So, it's good for us to keep this in mind, that that doesn't mean that they are against the whole domain of measurement or observation. So if somebody points out, which is what I'm hoping to now point out, that in this grand mention of the cosmos, it's not what we do in cosmology, it's just physical cosmology. It is a branch of physics. No biologist doing cosmology. We should keep this in mind. What has happened is we are simply dealing only with physical cosmos. Almost by definition, as if the other spiritual cosmos doesn't exist. So we can talk about how the age of the universe, the size of the universe, everything to do with the physical part of it. That becomes a measure of primary reality. So, to point out that in this large mansion that there are other rooms other than the kitchen doesn't mean one is against the kitchen. One needs to eat food also. But there is also the bedrooms where love can be made, That is a different kind of room, right? So, therefore, don't put up this as an opposition, as if when one points out limitation of something or some of the fundamental assumption, that is not to be set up as an opposition to something or an exclusion of something. To me, it seems perfectly obvious. Every human being that at least I have known is interested, not always professionally, in the external world, but also occasionally in their internal world. And where one tends to discover many, many undiscovered rooms. So let me maybe finish this by quoting another rima. This is from the oldest Upanishad. Maybe I'll first of all say this in English. It begins with Om, which is impossible to translate. But then there is fullness or wholeness here, wholeness there, wholeness everywhere. And if you take wholeness out of wholeness, what remains is wholeness. Om Purnamadaha, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamudachyate, Purnasya Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vishishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. I'll stop here.
Thank you, Ravi, very much indeed. Absolutely wonderful. Mind, experience, the whole philosophy of the now. Excellent. Right. Now, you think you're going to ask questions. Yes, you are, but to your next-door neighbours. So you've got 5 minutes now to discuss this with your friends close to you or with the people you don't know close to you, whatever you prefer. And then we'll come back to general questions for Ravi.
Okay.
Ravi, that was absolutely excellent.
Money changes that one. Yes.
Okay. Let's come back to the session again. And it's now question... Question time to Ravi. So, who's going to have the first question? Always best to get in first.
And please don't, there's no need to be try to be nice to me. You can. I'm quite accustomed to it.
Okay.
Eyes of flesh see flesh.
Not too close.
Eyes of spirit see spirit. Why is so? So the fundamental underlying question is, what is the mechanism of seeing so that this can happen?
It's a question of why three?
First of all, I there had simply quoted St. Paul, but you can see exactly that in Goethe, in Plotinus, and certainly the whole of Indian tradition repeatedly speaks about it. For example, the Mundaka Upanishad, Paramavayada Brahma, Brahmayava Bhavati, that unless one is like sees like, that in order for me to see something spiritual, I need to have something spiritual in me. Now, we could say, for example, if I were to rephrase your question, you and I as human beings see something. Is a cat seeing the same thing? To be sure, I don't know. But on the other hand, it certainly would make some sense to us that the ability to see depends on the kind of instrument one has. So if the whole idea of spiritual reality is that it is subtler than the mind and the body, then I need to have some instrument that can actually relate with something subtler than the body and the mind. Therefore, to say spiritual eyes.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I was going to ask you, Ravi, to expand on one thing you said.
Where is it?
Over here.
Sorry.
Because you translated the second noble truth as the origin of suffering is selfishness. And other people have translated it attachment, and other people desire. And I'm very anxious to know how which word is best. And behind this is my concern that when we have manifestations of love, there is an appropriate suffering, you know, like Jesus weeping over Jerusalem, and an inappropriate suffering. Yes. So how exactly should I understand the second noble truth and these different ways in which the original word, I presume it's in Pali, are translated as selfishness, attachment, desire, and so on?
Yes. The Pali word is tanha, and as you know, Pali is really like the vernacular of Sanskrit language. The Sanskrit word is trishna, which is which becomes tanha in Pali. And trishna, it will be closer to craving. It's often translated as desire. So not so much translated as attachment, but the most frequent translation is desire. But then, as you I'm sure know, in the Buddhist tradition, the question has been periodically raised, isn't desire for nirvana also desire? Is this going to create suffering? So, therefore, the question, the usual answer in the whole Buddhist tradition has been that, okay, if you begin with completely self-centered desire for nirvana, I alone should enter nirvana and there should be a band playing on the side when I'm entering it, that's fine. You begin from where you are. But as the practice itself cleanses your motivation. Now, the reason I use the word selfishness really was actually I spent about a week in a Theravada monastery in Thailand, and this very question was raised there by me, actually, which you're now raising. What will be an appropriate translation of this second noble truth of the Buddha? And the abbot there said, why make so much fuss? It simply means selfishness. So there it was coming from a person who is actually engaged in practice. And I always have this question in my mind. It is really silly of us to dismiss the scholars, but the scholars are not often searchers. I will take two more moments to respond to this question. Several years ago, my partner and I were responsible for being the overall editors of a series of 8 volumes called The Inner Journey, Views from the Christian Tradition, Views from the Buddhist Tradition, etc. Our greatest difficulty was to find an editor for each volume who was both a scholar and actually interested in the inner journey. You will be surprised how unusual that is. So, therefore, the question really, not to dismiss the scholars, but should we not at least give some credence to those who are actually undertaking the inner journey, what they understand by this? And in this context, I give you another example of a very important word in Buddhist tradition, shunyata. Nagarjuna introduced this, first century of the Common Era. Almost always is translated as emptiness or nothingness. And then I happened to spend a fair amount of time with Roshi Kabori, who was the head of Rinzai Zen for many years. And one day we had this conversation, and I must say I was completely surprised of him saying that as far as he's concerned, it is better to understand this as luminosity. Now, no scholar could possibly agree with this translation, because shunyata comes from the Sanskrit word shunya, meaning zero, zeroness or emptiness, nothingness. But now, what do I do? Stick with the scholars? Or this Zen master who has spent years and years actually practicing something. So we need to be a little careful about these words. So you don't need to get stuck with this business of selfishness. You could call it craving, selfish craving, etc.
Thank you.
Sorry?
Wait a moment. Who's got the mic?
She's reminding me of another part of the question here. Which was, please?
Over here.
Okay.
I wanted to ask a new question, actually.
Yes.
First of all, thank you very much. It was most interesting. And second, I wanted to ask, actually I have 2 points. One is, you said the mind doesn't have any experience. But then later on, you were talking about mind and awareness. Now, what is the difference between experience and awareness? That's one of my questions. And yes. The other one is more just a remark, so to say. I think in biblical tradition, there is the uniqueness and not everything is one, because the emphasis is on the relationship, on seeking the relationship, seeking to connect. And that is actually a part of the internal development. So I think, and for this you need 2 parties. That's why not everything can be one.
Yeah, I agree that we need 2 parties. Awareness is a matter of a direct experience. Part of the difficulty comes with the language here. For example, last evening when David Lorimer was speaking about, he actually attempted to make a distinction between ratio and intellectus. In Sanskrit, we have 2 words, manas and buddhi. Buddhi has the same root as the word buddha, awakening. Or one could say discernment. There, the point is that is being made, what we ordinarily call the mind is not the one that is experiencing it. I know even the word intellect these days gets, intellectus gets translated as intellect, but in Greek itself we have 2 distinct words for this. And the suggestion that the mind does not experience does not mean that mind is unimportant. Whatever observation is, well, look at the example of scientific observation, which is externalized, so it's easier to look at it. An instrument records something, then a scientist with his mind can look at this, not look, study this data and say, if we change some parameters here, what will be the change in observation? So the mind is necessary to even go from one perspective or one point of view or one theory to another theory, but it's not actually experiencing it. So that was the point I was trying to make, not to therefore say that mind is irrelevant. And furthermore, very strong, naturally, 10 scientists can look at the same data. Not everybody has a creative perspective on it. Somebody, one person may have it. So this is not, don't be against the mind. I think the point to be more made is the observation or experience is being done by the senses. And then the suggestion, which sometimes is not so much emphasized in spiritual traditions, that spiritual experiences also are sensed deeply. Okay?
Okay. Thank you, Ravi. Next one.
The emphasis on a talk such as this, and perhaps in this whole conference, is on the importance of the journey and how to lessen the distance between the self and the ultimate. But you talked about polarities, about how we are both unique in some way, and we're all also both connected. So could one not equally make a case for the importance of not journeying, and people who might not share your views or share our views might say, what is the point of all this journeying? Why can't we just be? Why is it not sufficient to be absolutely ourselves and not engage in this spiritual search?
Well, actually, practically all the great sages, after they have done a lot of journeying, actually say there is no journey, there is no traveler. I think, but they are saying it from a very different perspective. And the what is important, whenever we even use words like, I'm trying to connect myself with the Atma or with Brahma, or there is this journey, all of this is really mental projection. We don't know what God is. In fact, let me here remind you of a remark of Meister Eckhart, one of my favorite mystics. If there were a God of whom I had any idea, it will not be worth having him as God. This is Meister Eckhart. Because the mind is always projecting something or the other, and it will more or less claim to see what it projects. And, well, Peter Fenwick will tell me here, there are many experiences, so-called near-death experiences. If you come from a Christian background, you have a certain kind of experiences which are different if you come from a Buddhist background. So this is always part of our conditioning. So in a way, I'm not trying to disagree with you, because we need to begin from wherever we are. So the journey can begin from there. But I think it's a useful reminder that the peak of any mountain worth climbing is of necessity invisible. But the base can be visible. So whether we are moving in the right direction, that part can be visible. But to imagine that what is the top of the mountain, I think mostly remains a mental idea.
Could we not, however, decide that it's okay not to move, and it's not...
If you feel happy with that, that's perfectly fine. I'm not a missionary of any kind. You're perfectly okay to decide this. But then you would see an hour later, you would be not so easy about it. I can assure you.
Who's got the other mic?
I have it.
This is the second one. Who's got the second one? Oh, it's not got a Nana. Right.
Okay. Marilyn Monk. I've just two quick comments and a question. One comment, you know, I don't see, as you do, that science is a bottom-up cause-effect endeavor. Science is not a bottom-up cause-effect endeavor going in the direction of higher complexity of evolution, for example. It's also top-down and middle-out, and everything's interconnected. And in fact, if you just think of science in terms of DNA and the environment, you could think bottom-up, DNA is a master molecule, it's determining everything. But the DNA, what it can do, is totally determined by the environment, which is top-down. In fact, everything's connected to everything else. I don't make the polarity between science and religion bottom-up and top-down. The other comment is, what was it? Can't think. Well, the question was about, was about whether the scientists had a feeling for the organism. There's a book written about Barbara McClintock about that. And, I think that good scientists aren't divorced and detached from what they're looking at. They have a definite feeling involvement with the organism. If I'm, I can sense whether my cells are happy, if the DNA is in a tangle and needs help, and, you know, there's a definite feeling involved there, which is important. And the question's about one's transformation and uniqueness. I can see that as a contradiction, because if one's transformation is dissolving the ego, dissolving all boundaries, and merging with the whole, as it were, then my uniqueness has gone. And if in the presence of God, my uniqueness is present, is there, I don't really want to go, because I quite like to imagine that one's limited ego is renounced in the presence of God.
Well, three different things. Maybe I should, first of all, the question of whether the whole universe, as it were, comes from the lowest level of consciousness or from the highest level. That is the point I was trying to make. That doesn't mean that there is, for example, something is evolved up to here, something is evolved up to here. They can interact with each other. Nobody is suggesting contrary to that. But that things begin from matter rather than from spirit or consciousness. That's the distinction I was trying to make. And then jumping to your third point about uniqueness and oneness, this is where the difficulty comes. uniqueness can, of course, lead to egotism more and more and more. I alone matter, everybody else out of the way. But all the occupation with the oneness, you can see the terrible destructiveness of this has emerged in India. You pay no attention to anybody who is completely unique, different from you. It's easy to say everything is one. You would hardly ever see any of the Indian scholars paying any attention to any other religion, for example. They would say, oh yeah, they all lead to the same God. Therefore, we don't need to study them. So the question of this basic idea of oneness actually has had more deleterious effects, in India at least, because there it is a fundamental part of the cultural tradition. And therefore, I think it'll be very much helpful there, definitely, to be also aware that the person who is doing the lawn mowing for me is quite a unique individual, needs to be taken care of. So I think this idea of oneness, when it becomes merely a mental idea, actually ignores awareness of any individual around you.
I'm intrigued by the idea of awareness, and I'm wondering if one supposes that we have a universe which is infinitely aware, that in a way you have a definition of God. It's a panpsychic view that if you have an infinite awareness, that is everything, and that maybe Alan Watts had the idea that maybe somebody with infinite awareness, God with his infinite awareness, gets a little bit bored. So he creates the rules of the universe and he splits the awareness up into cells of, and we are perhaps those cells. We are in effect part of God. And he's deliberately forgotten himself to make things more interesting. I just wonder whether you've got any thoughts on those sorts of ideas.
Well, certainly having infinite awareness, one should therefore allow the possibility that they also have some wisdom and would do something which is actually helpful for everybody rather than just having whatever else that comes to their mind. But this is all kind of very speculative thing here.
Okay, and this has to be the last question. And can you keep it brief and
yes.
Ravi a short answer?
Okay.
Ravi, I'm very suspicious of this whole idea of getting away from the ego. I think it's a fact that we need a strong ego. An ego is necessary at some stage, and without a strong ego, there's nothing to get away from even, you know. And so it's a necessary part of our psychological development to develop a strong ego. When Carl Jung was going through his psychological transformation and his journey, he said that if he didn't have a strong ego, he would have gone mad.
Yes, I think since he has asked me to be very brief, so I will speak quickly. First of all, the word ego in English comes from Latin as well as Greek. Every major enunciation of Christ, such as I am the way, the truth and the life, begins with the word ego. So don't be against the word ego. Ego can be translated as atma, sounds very juicy. But ego is necessary and important. In fact, my own teacher, Madame de Salzman, on one occasion I actually went to her, said I'm fed up with my own vanity. I used to be even more vain than I am now, and that I'm just wasting time and energy, that I gain nothing from it. She actually looked at me and she said, ego is a good servant, but a bad master. Who needs a servant who has no energy, wants to just sit around doing nothing? But if the servant begins to make all the decisions in the household, that's where the problem comes. Anybody, do you think the Buddha could sit under the Bodhi tree for 49 days without having a strong ego? Ego there means will, determination, stick-to-itness. All this is part of the ego. But not being driven by the ego is a different matter. It's awareness of something subtler than myself. That's the whole meaning of anything sacred. So, not to be against the ego, in fact, I often say, only the rich can practice poverty. The poor have no choice.
Okay. Thanks very much. Well, we're going to have to come to the end of this session. I love the questions as much as the talk. And, of course, why should we go on a journey is a wonderful question. But you all know the Zen story of the gateless gate and the pathless path. That's clear. But do you know the story of three people climbing a wall? The first one came to the wall, couldn't get over it. Oh, God, it was so difficult. Helped by his mate and finally got over. Got to the top and laughed and laughed. Second one, same difficulty, got to the top and laughed and laughed. And finally, the guy down below said, "What are you laughing at?" He just said, "There's no wall." Ravi, thank you so much. I mean, it was absolutely wonderful. It was a great talk. So let's all thank Ravi for his talk.